And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIT 89.5 FM. And, of course, we are recalling the events of April 1994 in Rwanda. And we're doing it the old-fashioned way. We're talking about the facts as we know them. We're not painting you a big picture that you would, you know, the kind of thing that Bill Clinton would like to whisper in your ear, or a little hug from Blair about how we all have mutual feelings and care. And we're led by a visionary in Kigali. We're not doing that. We're talking about what happened, who might be responsible, and how you we distribute responsibility. We just established, by the way, in our conversation with Dr. Tejan and Rudasingwa, that yes, indeed, the RPF has impunity. And that's a rather important detail for people to recognize. He concurs with the view of Carlo Del Ponte, that failure to prosecute the RPF would create a bad history for Rwanda. We're joined now by Christopher Black. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hey. Good afternoon.
Hey, Christopher, thanks an awful lot. I should tell our listeners that you represented General Augustin Ndindilimana, a major figure in Rwanda in the events of 1994, about which we're speaking today.
Correct.
And that he was accused by the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court for Tribunal for Rwanda of involvement in a conspiracy to commit genocide and acts of genocide and orders for people to do all these things. And you defended him and were successful, and he has been now acquitted of all charges. Am I right?
That's right.
And by the way, where is he today now that he's acquitted?
Like the other 10 men so far who've been acquitted, they're all sitting in a UN safe house in Arusha in Tanzania, where the ICTR is located.
So they're half prisoners, even though they've been acquitted.
Right. They're more or less in forced exile.
Yes.
Even though they've been acquitted, they're treated as if, by the countries they were arrested in, where the families are, they're treated as if they're criminals.
So if you're accused, they will put you in a UN jail, and if you're acquitted, they will not let you out.
Well, they're free to roam around, but they can't go far because they risk assassination by the RPF.
Well, indeed, they don't live very far from a rather important figure who doesn't like them.
Right.
Just to begin with, Chris, we were speaking just now with Dr. Tejan Rudasingwa, who was a former a chief of staff to Paul Kagame,
right?
And we were reviewing history. And I just want to, and I want to do that with you. On April 6, 1994, President Habyarimana, together with his counterpart, the president of Burundi, both of them Hutus, were returning from a peace meeting in Dar es Salaam, and their plane was shot down. Now, just to set the context further, Mark Doyle in the BBC, I was reading him, he was helping us all recall, he said the plane was shot down. He doesn't attribute any, this time he doesn't say who he thinks did that. Plane was shot down. And then he said that was followed by a meeting of the Hutu extremists, who then seized power and initiated the genocide of 1994. Now, your client would have been one of those people. He's talking about the generals who met on the night of the 6th.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess let's just start with a naked question here. Did your client participate in a media conspiracy that night to seize power and to commit genocide?
No, that's completely false. It's amazing that people still put out these stories because they're fantastic. The actual, what happened on the night of the 6th is that as soon as the plane was shot down, we know by the RPF, the Army General Staff, and in fact, General Ndindilimana, I think, called for the meeting, a meeting to take place of all the senior Army officers in Kigali at that time. And they attended the meeting at one of the military camps, but they also invited General Dallaire and the commander of the UN forces in Kigali, the Belgian Colonel Luc Marchal. So both of those men were present at the meeting. It was not a meeting of the Hutu extremists. It was a meeting of Army and gendarme and UN officers to discuss what to do next. Mm-hmm. And in fact, these officers invited General Dallaire and Colonel Marchal in order to ask the UN for their assistance in helping them through this crisis and how to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was no meeting of the Hutu extremists. That's completely false.
Yeah. And Let's walk. Take us one step back. What was the general doing that day? What did he learn of the death of the president, and how did he react, and what happened to him on the? Uh-huh. If you could just walk us through April 6th.
During that evening, the plane was shot down around 8:20 in the morning. In the evening, I think just before that, he was at dinner with the director of the National Ballet in Kigali himself.
That's where you'd expect a conspirator to be,
right? And so the news came through that the plane had been shot down. He immediately went to Camp Kigali, I believe, the main army camp, and met with some army officers there. And over the next couple of hours, they couldn't find Dallaire. Strangely enough, they didn't know where he was for 2 or 3 hours. He was missing. They tried to contact Dallaire. They contacted Marshall and conveyed the message they wanted to have a meeting. And the meeting was convened around 10 p.m., I think, like an hour and a half after the plane was down.
Mm-hmm.
They met at the École Supérieure Militaire, ESM, the military college, on the base.
Mm-hmm.
And Dallaire showed up, I believe, around 10:30 or something. I'm not sure exactly what time he showed up, but Marshall and he showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a discussion about what happened. It was strange in a way because it was quite clear. Everybody who was at that meeting told me everybody knew the RPF shot down the plane. That was quite clear.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd been attacked, and that was the launching of a final offensive by the RPF.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some suspicions the UN was involved in helping them with that. And yet they still invited the two leaders of the UN forces in Kigali to come to that meeting to discuss what to do. So there was no possibility they could plan anything against two civilians without the UN knowing about it.
An important detail, and I really hope our listeners will focus on facts as opposed to sort of the sweeping history that you might get in a novel about the Civil War or something. They had lost their commander-in-chief, I forgot to mention. General Sabimana was in that plane and was killed.
Yes.
They had to find a new general to replace him, a new officer.
That's correct.
And they chose someone. So who was this leader of the great Hutu conspiracy that they would have chosen? Who did they choose, and why did they choose him?
There were several names proposing, but it ended up they chose General Gatsinzi, who later became a senior general in the RPF forces after they took power, and then became Minister of Defense in Rwanda. And he was chief
of staff. Paul Kagame's Minister of Defense.
That's right.
So the conspiring Hutu extremists chose the same guy that Kagame chose.
Yes, exactly.
That was brilliant.
And General Gatsinzi was in charge for the next 10 days or so when the mass media accepted standard version has it that a lot of killings took place by the army, and yet he's never been charged with anything. He was, in fact, promoted up the ranks and to become Minister of Defense.
Yeah, if we were to accept the prosecutor's vision, which is that whoever was running the military, quotes, junta, would be, you'd have to go up the line, and he was in charge.
That's right, and he was never charged. Instead, the man who took over from him a couple of weeks later, about the 19th or 20th of April, General Bizimungu was charged. When he was just given a fait accompli, whatever had happened, he was just handed that on a plate and told to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he's charged, but Gatsinzi was never charged. And it's quite clear why, because if he was charged and had to come to the tribunal, then he would have to start talking about who really did what. And the world doesn't want that to come out.
Well, incidentally, he later became that one who had the responsibility to negotiate an attempt at a ceasefire, which turned into a long carnival of a joke, right?
But yes.
And during which, to my knowledge, and perhaps, and certainly you would know better than I, that he never at any time did anything other than try to get a negotiated ceasefire, and said repeatedly that the RPF was not willing to engage in a ceasefire. And we have to underline that we're talking about could lives have been saved.
Oh, it's clear, because from the very first night of April 6th, and there was a following meeting the morning of the 7th with Dallaire and Marshall present, following up on that first meeting, there was a second meeting. And in both meetings, the army and gendarmerie again asked Dallaire, because they asked him on the night of the 6th, to convey a message to the RPF to stop their attack, because they had launched attacks on the night of the 6th. They asked him to pull back, stop the attacks, and negotiate and follow through with the Arusha Accord. and mm-hmm. they got just refusal after refusal. Delay said Kagame's, he just refuses to deal. He's going on, no matter
mm-hmm.
what.
Mm-hmm.
On April 12th, it got so serious that because the army was in dire straits, they offered an unconditional surrender. You can believe this, an unconditional surrender on the 12th of April, just 6 days after the plane goes down, before many people are killed except what the RPF had killed, several thousand. The Army offers a complete surrender. And in that offer, they said, we'll surrender, you win, but we want to combine your forces and our forces with the UN forces to go back on the streets because there's no police force, and bandits are taking advantage and killing people. We want to use our forces combined to stop these killings by bandits and ne'er-do-wells and looters and so on. Because that's all that was going on at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And Kagame again refused.
Mm-hmm.
Killings could have stopped on the 12th completely. That
yes.
could have all been over.
And
Kagame didn't want
yes.
that. And that's why a lot of his men, like Ruzibiza and Tedor, I think, left after. They're
mm-hmm.
disappointed in what he did.
They were a little bit surprised themselves.
Right.
They thought, my general, they're offering us everything on a platter. And the general said,
no. And
no.
The reason is clear, he didn't accept that offer of even unconditional surrender, because eventually he knew that if he accepted it, he'd have to negotiate with the government that offered the surrender.
A degree of sharing.
He'd have to have a degree of sharing power, and he didn't want that. As Alison DeForge testified in our trial in 2006, that the story put out by Kagame that he acted to stop the genocide is a complete myth. She said his only aim was to take power, on all power, by any means whatsoever. And
mm-hmm.
Alison DeForge said that.
Mm-hmm.
Who wrote the book "Leave None to Tell"? Leave no story, not to tell the tale, or something like that.
Yes, Now there's a new essay titled "Leave None to Tell the Other Side of the Story."
yeah.
We're talking to Christopher Black, who successfully defended General Augustin Dendilimana, and you summarize for us. By the way, this we're talking about a powerful myth, and the myth was that a group of Hutu extremists conspired, and we're talking about the political people and army people.
Mm-hmm.
So could you, there have been two political trials, there's government one and government two,
mm-hmm.
and my memory is that every single individual in government two was acquitted.
That's right.
Every single one.
Yes, every cabinet minister was acquitted, and on all the senior army officers and gendarme officers have been acquitted. Of the conspiracy, in fact, anybody charged with conspiring to exterminate Tutsis has been acquitted. And it's been found not only that they're not guilty, but the judges have gone further in several trials and said there's no evidence of any conspiracy whatsoever to do so.
So that leaves us a prime suspect.
Exactly.
Or rather, in terms of who started this and who wouldn't agree to ceasefire. Now, by the way, let's just point this out. You just said very clearly that the government people were not involved in that. But now it took 20 years to come to this point.
Mm-hmm.
20 years after, they say, well, no, actually they didn't.
Right.
So somebody has been holding on to power for 20 years in the name of a lie.
Yeah, and the lie is being perpetuated and repeated ad nauseum as we sit here because
so
of the anniversary.
So I take it you don't believe Bill Clinton, of all people.
No, because...
You're skeptical about Bill Clinton, and even Tony Blair, two of the finest individuals Western civilization ever produced.
Well, as Boutros Ghali said, I think to Robin Philpott in 2004 in an interview, the Americans are 100% responsible for what happened in Rwanda.
That's a Boutros Ghali.
Yes, and what he meant by that is that the big lie put out by the Americans, especially Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, that the Americans had nothing to do with Rwanda, and they should have acted, but they didn't. And
mm-hmm.
and they use that continually as a justification for humanitarian interventions, quote-unquote, everywhere,
mm-hmm.
to justify their attacks on people. That was a big lie because the Americans were directly involved in Rwanda and controlled the entire war logistically, politically, and militarily.
Yeah, could you remind us how the war began? When did this start? Everybody sort of picks up the story on April the 6th with the dramatic downing of the mm-hmm. president's plane. When did the war begin?
The war began on October 1st, 1990, and it began just the main complaint before that by the RPF side was that the Rwandan government wasn't allowing Tutsi refugees who'd fled years before back into the country, which was not true. Mm-hmm. Individual Tutsis had been allowed back individually for 30 years and had come back. But they wanted, they proposed then moving, I think, 300,000 or 400,000 back from Uganda.
And that was, that also was being negotiated.
That was being negotiated.
And Arusha Accords agreed to it.
Right. Yeah, and they were, well, it was agreed to before that. It was agreed to in September 1990. There was an agreement signed between the RPF and Uganda and UNHCR that the Rwanda would allow a mass return. But they, the RPF had to send a logistics team into Rwanda to work with the government to figure out how to do it, because Rwanda is a very, very tiny country. And its land is totally occupied by the present occupants. So to bring in, well, that, I think the population was 3 or 4 or 5 million. So bring in almost 20, a large number of people like that. Where are they going to be housed? Where, how are they going to be fed? Where are they going to get jobs? What were they going to do? Were they going to come with their cattle? So all this had to be negotiated.
Mm-hmm.
So they were expected on October 1st. They were, that team was expected in Kigali. They didn't show up. Instead, the RPF launched an offensive from Uganda. In fact, the Ugandan army, in the guise of the RPF, attacked.
Yeah, but tell us, who would, is it true that they were in Ugandan uniforms, or that they were members of the Ugandan army? What's that about?
They were all the men who were killed or captured carried Ugandan army identity cards, and all the vehicles captured were Ugandan army vehicles and artillery pieces. And in fact, Kagame himself was a member of the Ugandan army. He was, I believe, the deputy head of Ugandan army intelligence. He may still be, for all I know. He may still be in the Ugandan army, hold a rank in that army.
You know, Professor Renshins testified to that effect. He said there's no evidence that he ever left the army.
No, I suspect that he's
still
a
Ugandan
member. Yeah, he's probably a high senior general now, because they're very close. So it was put out that the RPF was a separate, it had split from the Ugandan army and deserted en masse and took all its equipment and invaded. No, it's not possible.
Yes. By the way, also, Chris, you must notice, we're dealing with people who seem to have no problem lying. President Museveni at the time said he had no knowledge of any of this and that he was very disappointed, except that he kept his borders open and resupplied them when they needed supplies.
Yes.
And later, in 1996, when the two of them, Uganda and Rwanda, invaded the Congo, they both denied it.
Right.
They denied it.
Right. Well, we found a letter in dated August 1994 from Kagame to a fellow Tutsi in Burundi, but talking about the plans for Zaire between him and Museveni. Said, I had a meeting with my big brother Museveni, and the Hutus are in the way. So until we get the Hutus out of the way, our plans for Zaire have to be on hold, but don't worry, we'll go ahead with it eventually. And that's what turned out to be. This is in August 1994, this letter was written.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows they had plans for the invasion of Zaire, in my view, as far back as 1994, and perhaps even earlier than that.
Yeah. Well, they certainly, that was another matter, and we should talk about crimes here. People find it, seem to be comfortable with this problem. The refugee camps were created all around Rwanda as a result of the fighting and massacres of 1994.
Mm-hmm.
And they had United Nations camps established with the United Nations flags.
Yeah.
But Paul Kagame's army fired on those camps with artillery.
Right, and they began that in 1994 with the big killing started around April 8th, 9th, when the RPF shell began using high-explosive shells on the Hutu refugee camp at Nyachonga, which is just north of Kigali, because over the fighting between 1990 and 1994, for a million Hutu peasants had been forced out of their farms and homes in the north, which is the breadbasket of Rwanda, forced south by murders and horrible atrocities by the RPF forces. So they fled south to the capital. 1 million people were living in miserable conditions around the capital in this camp, Nyachonga. On the 8th or 9th, I believe, they began shelling that camp. They killed thousands of Hutu in that heavy shelling. And then the rest fled through the capital, and it caused mass chaos.
Mm-hmm.
You had a million people flowing through a town of maybe 200,000 to 350,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
And it was terrible what they did, and they didn't stop doing that.
Yeah. We're speaking to Christopher Black, successful in the defense of General Augustin Dindilimana, who remains in a halfway house in Arusha, Tanzania, together with others who've been acquitted, despite the fact that they're acquitted. Let's go back again. I hate, well, I want, you're the kind of person we want to talk to about this, inform people about what happened on the 6th, 7th, because the cases in the tribunal have pretty much demolished the theory of a conspiracy, but nonetheless, let's just General Dindilimana and the other officers, what did they want to do on the night 6th and 7th? Did they declare themselves a government and say, we're taking power? What did they say?
No, they said they only had a meeting because they didn't know where the prime minister was. And Dallaire knew but didn't tell them where she was. They assumed she was under UN protection. But they met with Dallaire because it was obviously a military attack. They said, we're having a meeting to decide how to maintain security, because without security, you can't have a government functioning.
Mm-hmm.
Without military security. So they asked Dallaire and the UN, how do we maintain it? And in fact, it was agreed on the night of the 6th that three men, go and meet the U.S. ambassador the next morning at 9 a.m. with all the other foreign ambassadors, Belgian, French, German, whoever else was around, and the head of the UN, Bobo, Jacques-Roger Bobo, who was Dallaire's boss.
Mm-hmm.
So Dindilimana, General Dindilimana went, Colonel Robalinda, an army colonel, went, and Colonel Bagasora was at that meeting. They went to Ambassador Rawson's residence.
U.S. ambassador.
So these guys aren't preparing to kill Tutsi. They're willing to meet with the American ambassador. They go to a meeting. They go at 9 o'clock. Nobody else shows up. So the three of the senior army officers of the Rwandan army are sitting in the U.S. ambassador's house for over an hour and a half, waiting for the rest of the world to show up. Nobody shows up, and the U.S. ambassador tells them nothing. And then so they just get fed up and decide they left.
Mm-hmm.
And they went back. They had to go to another meeting scheduled at 10 a.m. or 10:30 a.m. at the same place. They went back to that meeting and met Dallaire again with Marshall, again to discuss what to do. And they agreed with Dallaire that the army would support the government, they support the Arusha Accords, and they want the Arusha Accords to go forward. That was made explicit. And they even drew up a document agreeing that Prime Minister Agathe Uwilingiyimana would continue as Prime Minister.
Mm-hmm.
All they would do is replace the ministers who had been killed on the plane, assassinated on the plane by the RPF. And that was the only change in the government. Otherwise, the government remained the same as it was before April 6th, which was a mixed ethnic government, Tutsis and Hutus. Multi-party government in which pro-RPF and RPF people held key ministries.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's important to bring in that Dr. DeForge in 2006 testified when she was asked if there was a conspiracy by the Rwandan government or army or military to kill Tutsi. She said, no, that's an impossibility because it was a mixed ethnic regime of Hutus and Tutsis. It was impossible for them to do such a thing. So she was asked what her new theory was. She said, well, I don't really know now.
Uh-huh. By the way, I was in court when she thought she knew, but
she did change over time. And in 2006, a testimony of hers is very important. She totally changed her opinion, and she said it's a myth that Kagame acted to stop genocide, and it's a myth that the Rwandan government A was a Hutu government and B planned to commit genocide. It did not.
This is Alison DeForge.
Alison DeForge, the authority herself.
So that leads me to believe in evolution.
Yes. I mean, some academics who were adamant actually changed their point of view as they learned out what the real facts were and were willing to state so.
Mm-hmm.
And Renschens is another one who changed rapidly.
Yes. By the way, can we say about your client that his martyrdom, in a way, because he's lost 20 years of his life and been shown to be innocent, but didn't he land in trouble because he basically was an honest man and refused to lie?
Yes, he was in a judgment in our case when he was first released, because he was cleared of most major charges back in 2011, and he was just acquitted of the remaining charges this year. The judges actually said that they believed the charges they brought against him were made for political reasons, that being that he'd been deliberately arrested for one reason only, to force him to put pressure on him to testify against Colonel Bagasora.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was held in jail to press him to do that. And when, in fact, he agreed to testify, but not by being pressured, by being thrown in jail to do it,
mm-hmm.
he said, you release me, I'll testify. But so those that didn't work out, so they left him in prison and had to fabricate charges against him after the fact to justify holding him. And that's what they did. They spent 4 years cooking up charges against him of all sorts of terrible things.
So people who watch crime shows on television will understand what we're talking about.
Yeah, the judge said he was framed up.
How do you get testimony? And if you watch Hollywood, you'll find out.
Right. And in fact, well, now, in all these trials, it's replete with witnesses coming forward and telling the judges that they were forced to testify against their will and testify to falsehood.
Yeah.
Under pressure from the RPF.
Well, Chris, I think we at least have done our part for the day to remember and get some of the facts straight, but I bet we're going to have to revisit this because the waves of malarkey keep rolling in. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
You're very helpful. Thank you. You're bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Christopher Black, defense lawyer for Augustin de Nilimana, who is a fine gentleman, by the way, and it's a tragedy for him and his family that he had to go through this. But Bill Clinton sails merrily on, and the story in his wake is all this foolishness. You're listening to the Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM, and I thank everybody, and we'll see you next week. And remember, support us in the membership drive. We'll see you.